there's this world of entrepreneurship that we don't talk about that much. There are lots of great businesses out there that already have product market fit, that already have customers, that have revenue and profit, and you're taking over those businesses, and many of which are not sellable, right? There's a million reasons why. We look at it from a couple pillars. There's risk, there's growth, there's transferability and documentation.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly. Freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
All right, all right. It is the Brian and Ryan Show. What is up, my brother? How are you, Mr. Ryan Condie? Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun one. I was just on your show, so I'll let you give a plug for your podcast really quickly right out the gate.
Yeah, so it's called Let's Buy a Business. It's a podcast. We've got 300 plus episodes about how to buy a business, how to start something on the side, buy something on the side, or go full-time into entrepreneurship if you're W-2 and trying to make that switch to ownership.
Yeah, man, that's going to be the topic of today's show. We're going to hit on a bunch of topics. One of them is going to be how to buy businesses, why to buy businesses, how to sell businesses. And then what we're actually going to begin with probably is how to package businesses, because we have a lot of people, myself included, that got businesses that are profitable, but that doesn't mean that they're sellable necessarily. So before we get into all this good stuff, who is Ryan Condie and why should people stick around for the next 40, 50 minutes?
It's a big commitment, 45 minutes of your time here. So 2X this here. So I've built, bought, and sold lots of businesses. I bought 8 businesses in a 10-year span, done everything from software sales to e-commerce to content sites to buying small apps and software applications, SaaS businesses. I even started a candy factory 10 years ago. We got it to 80 employees, got into Sam's Club and Walgreens. Can tell you what it's like being in the candy industry and the whole nine yards there. So I feel like I've been through the gauntlet with some wins and some losses in the entrepreneurship world, and we're going to dive into all those. And I spend most of my time brokering deals. So exited my businesses in 2019, 2020, and I help online entrepreneurs, so people, e-commerce, SaaS businesses, content sites, actually exit their business. So we package up their business and find buyers and package the deal up together.
I think about this all the time about why do you keep going? Especially after you have an exit. And even if it's like a 7-figure exit, a 6-figure exit, or an 8-figure exit, but why do you keep doing what you're doing? And you're like, hey, I bought and sold 8 businesses over 10 years, and now I'm still doing it because you freaking love it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I think part of it too is like, it's a game, right?
And
I try to gamify everything, whether you're working out, whether you're playing with your kids or whatever you're doing. To me, business is just a game. As kids, I played every sport under the sun. I loved competing. It was fun. But as you get older, you don't really have the same options to compete. So it usually turns to business, and business is where you get your competitive juices going. So ultimately, there isn't let me just not do anything, Gene. Because a lot of times, in order to do great things, you have to have some screws loose. You have to view the world differently. And I feel like the second you stop moving, you're just going to move backwards. And so whether you want to continue moving forward or whether you're, I'm done, I exit, I just want to sit on a beach, that actually sounds really boring. Everybody wants that lifestyle, but I think purpose is driven from meaningful work and working with others and developing friendships. And if we're all sitting on a beach, you and I would have never met. We'd never had these fun conversations, and we'd never had conversations with all of our other guests. So part of it is you keep going. I love what I do. I love talking business. I love talking deals. I love talking structure and strategy. And I see myself doing that till the day I die, right? And you might be 85 years old and people are like, why don't you retire? And I'm like, I love what I do. This feels like retirement to me. This is all game. It's fun. I take it very seriously. I'm not messing around and taking shortcuts or anything like that. But at the end of the day, this is fun.
All right. So I'm going to introduce a new inaugural segment called What the Hell? Ryan, you started a candy factory. What the hell?
Yeah, I asked myself that too. So
how does that happen? We won't hit on it for too long because I don't think that many people are going to be looking at that as their asset class of choice.
The candy industry is crazy. I could drop some stats and we could talk for 2 hours in candy industry, but we won't. The quick background is my father-in-law and my own father spent their whole careers in the snack food industry and candy industry. So my father was the brand manager for Snickers, Brock's. He ran all these different companies in the candy space. My father-in-law started the first Rice Krispie Treat company in America 40 years ago, right? Back in the 80s. So I just had this in my blood here in Salt Lake City. I started a gourmet fudge and chocolate business. We had some unique ways of how we grew it. We went into this with a few recipes that we'd had, and then we had to go in and craft our own recipes, built out the whole factory. And then from day one, we took some things that you would do in other types of businesses that when you get into the candy industry, it's very archaic. It's very far behind most technology. I remember showing some people in the industry how Google Calendar worked, and they could see my calendar and I could see their calendar, and their mind was blown. This is not that long ago. This is how far back the candy industry is. And so I enjoyed food. I enjoyed the candy industry. And then we built this factory. We scaled it. A couple of things we did, Brian, I think would be helpful and unique to the audience is when you're starting a business, you have to go, okay, where are the people that would buy my products? Where are they hanging out? So we actually found some similar, I'm not going to name any names. We found some similar candy businesses that sold similar items. If we were selling fudge, they'd be selling something high end, but not the exact same category because we'd had the same buyer. We hired someone from India for $3 an hour and they basically went into their website and there's always spots in the website that said, where can I find your products? You put in your zip code and there'll be 2 to 20 stores in Denver or 2 to 20 stores in San Diego where you can buy that. We created a list of 10,000, cost us about $200, I don't know, 60 hours with the VA. And we had a list of 10,000 stores that we thought, these are mom and pop candy stores that we thought would actually carry our products. And then I hired 5 stay-at-home moms to just dial, boom, set up meetings with me. We'd send samples. And we were able to scale to about 700 retail stores in the first 9 months by just doing that. And it was crazy. It was wild. I think there's a lot of free resources when you think about growing a business and just thinking outside the box. Where are customers buying? Where would they be buying our products? Will they be buying these other similar products? And we weren't really competing with them, but this is all information that's out there. And then fast forward a little bit, and then we started some other lines and we got into Sam's Club and got into Walgreens. And it was a fun ride. I'll tell you what though, Brian, when you have 80 employees in a factory, at any given day, 10% of them aren't going to show up. But that's not that fun. You start doing the math and someone's not doing their job and the roles aren't happening. It gets very stressful when you start having, what do you call it, like metal detectors in your warehouse. But not for employees. This is actually for your product. Because if someone eats your product and there's a broken screw or something in there, it's just not fun. It's not even just the lawsuit, but you just don't want anybody to get hurt. Those types of businesses have all sorts of challenges, but they're really fun. They're really fun to see people eat your product. And I'm relatively skinny, and it's because I binge eat a few times in my life. I binge eat so much candy that you just get sick and then you never eat it again. Work at a candy factory, own a candy factory. It's a good cure for not eating any candy.
I think what you said is freaking genius, dude. That is freaking genius. That is wonderful business advice because everybody is talking so much about Facebook ads. What is your paid ad strategy? We don't even do paid ads. We've tried a couple of times, but we keep going back to the reverting to the mean, which is who are we speaking to and where does that person hang out? And I think so many business owners just aren't that wonderful at answering that question. And if you know where your people hang out, just go there. And for us, like the way that me and you met was because I know that my people hang out in podcasts. Like they listen to podcasts. Like the person that thrives the most in our community is somebody that is an avid podcast listener. And we know the customer journey is they listen to me on another show. They binge 4 to 6 episodes of ours within a week on average. They normally say 4 to 6. We track all of this. And then they call to say, hey, like we've heard about this. Like what's going on? And that's how the vast majority of our people come in. So for us,
yeah,
going 3 podcasts a week. So it's exactly what you did. And you were in the CPG space. So it's just, you just went and you found out where your competitors were already stationed. And you're like, okay, cool. Here's who we're going to hit. I think that's freaking genius, man.
And to bring that wrap around, people, once they binge your product, in our case, it was candy and fudge. In your case, it's actually your content and your podcast. They're going to sign up. We knew if we could get our product and we would send out free samples nonstop. We were sending 20, 30 samples a day, right? This was a machine. And we knew if we could get our products into the hands of the buyer or the owner of that store, these are mom and pop bookstores, candy stores. It was like 75 to 85% of the time they were placing orders like that. So part of it is you just got to get in their ear, give them a little bit of taste. And then we knew it was such an easy sale after that.
The best sales is good marketing and the best marketing is good product.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to steal that.
I love it. I just stole it from Naval Ravikant, so you can thank him. And I'm sure he stole it probably from the ancient Greek or Japanese. As every good quote is. So dude, really interesting observation. So you go from brick and mortar candy factory to 8 online businesses. Huge pivot there. Why the pivot? Why online? Because you're friends with Walker Diable and he's the brick and mortar king. Like he's like, give me the brick and mortar.
I was actually doing online e-com before I started the Candy Factory. So it's almost like I went down the brick and mortar path for a while. But everybody's journey, it was a wonderful business. On the outside, it was growing like crazy. It was awesome. On the inside, it was the wrong business for me. I did not like having 80 employees. I did not like having metal detectors where I had to put my product through. That's so stressful. That just wasn't the right business for me. And from my background, it was sales and marketing and the vision and the plans. Whereas like getting into the nitty gritty of manufacturing and tracking butter prices and all those things, it really awful. Wasn't for me. And so if you think about what types of businesses are going to be impactful for you and where you can make the biggest difference, ultimately that wasn't for me. And so then I went back to my roots of online businesses and e-com, and I knew those were the spaces that I could do really well in because I had success in there before. And I stumbled upon my first acquisition. This was 2012. It was a company that took polyester ties, like those big fat ones from the 70s, and they would chop them up and turn them into wallets. And so I bought this business because I liked the products and they didn't have very many products on their site. So I hit up the owner and said, hey, do you want to sell your business? And he's like, no. And I was like, oh, okay, we don't want to be friends. And so we were friends after that. We talked every week or two. We always had a bunch of ideas. And then a few months later, out of the blue, he said, hey, do you want to buy this business? You seem like the best one with the most ideas. And I said, great. So how do you buy a business? And he goes, I don't know. I don't know how to sell a business. And so we figured it out from there. But that was my first foray into, there's this world of entrepreneurship that we don't talk about that much. And it's buy then build. It's walk or die build. There are lots of great businesses out there that already have product market fit, that already have customers, that have revenue and profit, and you're taking over those businesses. Do you buy? Do you start from scratch? It really just depends on what your risk level is, your skill sets are. And for me, I've started a bunch of businesses, but I've also bought a bunch because there were times that it made sense for me to buy that business than it was starting from scratch. And going back to that transition of going back to online, I started going down the path of buying more online businesses because I wanted to get year 5, year 10, and I didn't want to start from scratch. And we can all go back and look at, back in 2014 and 2015, it was like, basically Facebook was paying you to run ads. We all wish we could go back to that day. Nobody knew that at the time. So that was a little bit why I got back into the online side of things. The other piece to it is when you have an online business, there's lots of pros and lots of cons. You're competing with anybody in a basement. And on the flip side, you can compete from anywhere in the world, right? So you can run your business from anywhere. Obviously, you're working from there, but you can do that because of an online business. And so that was really important for me. And with my family and kids, we've been able to take extended stays in lots of different places while still living in the mountains of Salt Lake City, which is where we wanted to be. We started to figure out where we wanted and what we valued from a lifestyle perspective. And that fit directly in line with my skill sets of going back to online business.
I think it's really important because you had clarity in two different directions. You had clarity on what you wanted your life to look like. What were you optimizing for? And you also had clarity, like Walker talks about in Buy Then Build, where you knew what your skill sets were and you knew what you brought to the table. Just like right now, I want to enter the boutique hotel space, which is literally just business disguised as real estate. And I know I'm the sales and marketing and branding side of it. Person that I'm going to partner with to run that business or run that empire that we end up building in 2025 is going to be somebody that maybe I'm not the best of friends with. Maybe it's not somebody that I'm going to be buddies with. It's probably going to be somebody that is, hey, I can run the back end of a hotel with my freaking eyes closed. I know every single gear shift and lever that I need to pull to be able to run this thing like a freaking clock. And that's what they freaking geek out over is like that and looking at a back office P&L, back of house, I'm front of house. And then that's where magic happens. And I really like that you said that because you're like, I'm sales and marketing. Give me something that is operationally sound already because I'm not building another candy factory, right?
100%. You nailed it. And I think everybody's got their skill sets, what they're bringing to the table. But they also have what they like to do and what problems they can actually solve. I learned very quickly that I didn't want to solve 80 employees and I didn't want to be hands-on in the manufacturing piece of it versus how do I get into what I'm best at? And I think that's applicable to any business, right? You either need to find a partner that has complementary skill sets or find a business that has already solved the things that you don't want to solve or don't know how to solve.
That's what you did. You're like, I like the product. You guys are already making profit, but you don't have that many offerings. You don't have that much traffic. I could help there. I've done this a million times. I've got this. I absolutely love that. So really quickly, I want to take a small pivot. So you now broker a lot of deals and you guys focus specifically at Quiet Light on online businesses. So, you know, there's a huge difference between an online business that's profitable versus an online business that's running versus an online business that can actually sell. Can you talk a little bit about how to actually go about the process of packaging an online business for sale? Because I've had Walker on here, I've had John Warlow on here, who literally wrote the book Built to Sell. And it's just so interesting to learn about all the different things that you need to have in place, the checklist, if you will, to actually have your business be a sellable asset on the balance sheet.
Yeah, that's a good question. And so I'll talk pretty high level and then pick out whatever you want to dive into. And let's dive deeper into any of those. And we can get
this is my favorite stuff.
Get into specific examples. So there's a million businesses out there, and many of which are not sellable, right? And they're not sellable because they're bad businesses, they're not profitable, blah, blah, blah. There's a million reasons why. We typically look at it from a couple different key columns and pillars. There's risk, there's growth, there's transferability and documentation. And let me just dive into those. When you think about any business, whether it's Main Street or online, it doesn't matter, but these all apply. Risks could be, are there certain dependencies within the business? A brick and mortar could be, hey, all traffic goes through this one street. That street went under construction, you could go under. Extremely common. Or on an online business, you might say, hey, all of our traffic comes from Pinterest. What if the Pinterest algorithm changes? Or what if the Google algorithm changes? Or what if Amazon makes a change here or a change there? Or iOS 14 update happens and all of a sudden you can't do attribution with your Facebook ads. Those are some dependencies. You could have like poor trends in the business. Obviously, anything that's trending down, it's going to be less desirable for buyers. And it's extremely common for sellers to just like love life on the way up. They mellowed out a little bit because they got bored. They started cashing checks. They forgot about their golden goose. The business starts to go down. Oh, I want to hurry and sell. Brian, what are you going to say? Whoa, the business is actually going down. I don't know if I want to buy this. Or the multiple that you're going to pay for it is significantly lower, right? The next thing would be growth. Do you have opportunities to grow the business? Are there low-hanging fruit that you can do? Is there existing growth within the product or services that you offer? At the end of the day, as a buyer, a lot of times we're looking at those growth opportunities. And if it looks easy, it's not, right? There's nothing easy here. It's very rare because if it was easy, somebody else would have already done it. So I usually recommend if you're coming in and buying a business, you need to have 10 ideas of how you're going to grow it because the first six aren't going to work. Maybe two break even and one or two do really well. Okay. That third piece, we talked about transferability. An extreme example of transferability issues would be, say, for example, Brian, you got a YouTube channel, you're the face of it and you want to sell it to someone else. But everybody has trust in you and built everything around you, it's very difficult to actually sell that business. And if you do, you're just going to get a little bit of money down and then you're going to get a big seller note, which means deferred payments over a long period of time. And that's what you run into with like influencer businesses where they're the face of it. It might generate and kick off a ton of cash, but there's not a lot of business value that could be transferred over. Another example would be if there's a dependency on the owner's putting 60 hours a week, the owner does everything and you can't unplug that owner because everything in that business would just fall apart. If that owner hasn't taken a month-long vacation or 2 weeks of vacation ever, that's a red flag. Everything is going to fall into that owner, right? A common one that you'll see is you've got all these family relationships. If your lead supplier is your sister-in-law and your head of customer support is your mom, like all these things that intertwine with your family, it opens up another transferability issue and it's very difficult. And then look, at the end of the day, this is the thing you're going to run into the most. Businesses that aren't sellable, it's because they don't have clean books. They don't have good records. They don't have good standard operating procedures or SOPs. They just don't have good processes. And that is the number one thing. Because if I'm buying a business, I need to know how fast am I going to get paid back? Or am I going to be able to pay my loans? Or what am I actually buying? And if the numbers don't make any sense, then what are you buying? So many people try to cut corners on the numbers. And you could have this amazing brand, amazing business. But if people can't understand the numbers, they don't know what they're buying. And then I always say like that final piece is like the X factor is the entrepreneur yourself, right? You as the entrepreneur, if you're good, you've got all these things, you've built the business that looks like you and all these things are buttoned up, or you're really good on calls and conversations, you're trustworthy. That's a huge X factor. I've seen businesses that went for less because the seller was shady. The owner just didn't portray trust or even wasn't trustworthy to go that far. And so there's all these moving pieces to a business, and we can dive into any of those pieces because there's a lot of meat there.
Yeah. And real estate, especially, we talk about net worth equity versus cash flow. And it's funny because then when I sold my real estate, realized, oh, my net worth is tanking because you can't really put a value. Because when I started the business, I was very misinformed about how to value businesses. And I was just like, I heard 3X, 5X, here are all these multiples. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Just put a multiple on net revenue. That's how you value a business. But then very quickly from running the business, you're like, oh, dude, I can't put a valuation on this thing at all. This is 100% me. And I think there's a lot of people in that position that haven't yet made that realization where it's just, hey, like it really is dependent on you. And like my business is dependent on me right now. And we're being proactive and taking steps like that. One of the big things that you mentioned is like the books, even with different payroll processing, that's a huge thing. one of my buddies sold his business and he goes, dude, I had to go back because I switched payroll processors two or three times. We had two or three different ones in the beginning. I had to go back and like retroactively find every single pay stub that I paid people from 4 or 5 years ago. And it was hell on earth. So please, for the love of God, get your payroll combined. Get your books clean in the beginning. So that's what I'm learning right now.
Keep good records. You know, look, you're coming in. Say you want to buy a $5 million business. You're just not going to throw $5 million at someone. You're going to scrutinize everything with a magnifying glass. You're going to reconstruct all their books and their invoices. You're going to try to dive into every potential risk that there could be. And the more buttoned up you are, the higher the premium you can actually get for your business. If your business is just a mess and your book's all over the place, your business could be worth $5 million, but you're probably going to sell for 700 grand because nobody can actually tell what they're buying. They don't understand the risks, their legality that you may have had, or there's lawsuits that you haven't documented. And so that's why anytime as a business builder and you're taking risks off the table for the buyer, it's actually going to increase the value of the business. And so there's risk on both sides of the table, and deals happen when that shared risk is agreeable to both sides. So if you and I are doing a deal, we obviously are doing one that you think is good and I think is good. But if I'm doing a deal where I think it's amazing and you're like, dude, this deal sucks, well, you're just going to walk because the risks are imbalanced and we don't feel comfortable with the risks. And so it's important as a business owner that you build a business that is limiting the risk for the buyer, because then therefore they know exactly what they're going to get. And people say yes when there's clarity.
Yeah. A lot of people will ask, why are you doing all this stuff if you don't plan on selling? And my argument would be, that's the point of everything. It isn't necessarily to sell per se, but John Warlow, that's why I love his book so much, Built to Sell, is begin with the end in mind. Do that. Because in the future, like if you want to have stuff on the balance sheet, if you do want, you might as well go ahead and get your reps in, because this is how you learn. Like, well, by doing the thing.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, if your books and your standard operating procedures are all dialed in and buttoned up, you may never want to sell, but that's because your business is in such a good place or making, or you've got these systems that you can go to Greece for 2 months. All of a sudden you're like, why would I sell? And you shouldn't. You love the business and you've automated it. But without those other pieces that make it sellable, your business is probably just like a tornado at any given day. And putting out this fire and putting out that fire. And of course, you want to sell that business because it's not that fun.
I had a good friend that sold for high 8-figure. He said that the only time is when you should actually sell your business is when you have multiple offers and you're asking yourself every single night, why the hell am I selling this again? He's like, that's when you sell your business. He goes, because if you've got one offer and you're putting it all on that offer, it's not time, you're not ready to sell the business yet. So let's flip over a little quickly up to the buy side. Now we've been talking sell side, let's talk buy side. So somebody's working their corporate job, maybe they have 100K saved up, maybe they have a few 100K, and they've got equity in their homes that they're maybe able to use, and they're like, okay, cool, real estate's popping me out, $200 of cash flow per door. This multifamily's taking a while for me to raise money for. I want to buy a cash flowing business. I want to be a red-blooded American business owner. That's what I want to do. And I'm going to buy predictable revenue that's been going on for 3 years plus with cleanish books. I'm going to make it better and bring them into the 21st century. What are some tips we can give to this person in their pursuit for this American dream?
I love that example because you teed it up really well. And I think before we dive into, oh, this business model, that business model, you got to take a step back and say, where do I want to be in 5, 10, 15 years? What is the goal of this acquisition, right? Is it to quit my 9-to-5 and go full-time in this? Is it to support my whole family? Is it to support my partner and his family too? These are all different questions you need to ask would determine what's the size, what industry do you want to get into? You asked about how much, maybe they have $100,000 or $200,000 saved up, how they can actually finance the business. And then of course, where they want to live. Are they willing to move across the country? And they may not be. And okay, let's change what type of business we're looking for. So a lot of it's going to start with the end in mind, and then you work yourself backwards. When you do that, it starts to show you which types of businesses you should be looking at. What happens typically is, I want to buy a business. I pull up my phone and I look at Biz by Sell like I'm scrolling TikTok. Boom. And it is like, it's what you do with Zillow when it's 2 a.m. and you can't sleep. You're like, I'm going to check Zillow. Oh, let's see what the San Diego market does. Oh, like that's exactly what we all do. And that's the worst thing you could do when you're looking at buying a business, because it's just mind numbing, right? You're not actually looking at anything. If you're switching from a local service HVAC company to an e-commerce business, there's no correlation between anything there. And so you end up just driving yourself nuts. You'll never find the right business, right? So start with the end in mind and then start going down the path of, okay, these are the types of business models that make sense. These are the regions. This is the range that I can afford. Or if I wanted to get a loan or borrow money, such as an SBA loan, this is what it would take. These are the ranges. And then you start working yourself backwards into, okay, my lifestyle, I need to make X amount per month. And you start going down this path, right? Very clearly, you start having this thesis of, I want to buy a business that's making $500,000 a year. So after the loan payments, I have $250,000 to pay myself and grow the business and whatever, right? Once you have that, then you can actually go into this educated and say, I don't need to go look at every business under the sun, because every business when you start that's for sale looks awesome. It looks so fun. You're like, oh, the numbers check out. And then you're like, whoa, I don't know if I want to do this. And a story that I reference often is early on, I had an opportunity to buy a franchise here in Salt Lake City. And I had an opportunity to buy three locations. Okay. Three locations. And one location is, it's a lot of work. Three locations are like, okay, these are some interesting numbers, right?
You start put a district manager in. Yeah.
Yeah. You got it. You're big enough that you can start acquiring more. You got a manager in there. And between the three, you would be pulling in mid six figures. It starts to get interesting. And I remember doing the due diligence, all the numbers checked out. And one night, my wife is so much smarter than me. She doesn't care about business, doesn't like business, but she is always so smart when it comes to this. And she immediately turned to me and said, yes, but do you want to manage a bunch of 16-year-olds and their problems? And I was like, I'm out. That wasn't part of my thesis, but instantly I remembered going back to my days when I had 80 employees in the warehouse. And I was like, oh, I don't want 16-year-olds ever that I work with. That's just something I don't want to do. So instantly I started to make my shift into other acquisitions that would make sense. I think someone bought those three and probably crushed it, but I knew it wasn't the right business for me.
Was it a car wash franchise?
No, it wasn't. There was a food component. It actually kind of went crazy. I don't know if this is big elsewhere, but in Salt Lake City, they have these soda shops where you get this like dirty Cokes and those types of things. You're buying a $4 or $5 Coke, but it's got like coconut syrup in there, and they make it, they call it dirty Cokes. But these things will just have 10, 12 cars in the drive-thru all the time. And they actually can kick off a lot of cash. But I knew very quickly, okay, I need to change my thesis of what I'm looking for. I stopped looking at those businesses where I would have a bunch of 16-year-olds, and nothing against any 16-year-olds out there, but I just didn't want to work with a bunch of them. So
no, screw those 16-year-olds. Screw them. Yeah. Anybody that's under 18, don't listen to this podcast. Go to school.
They're just going to be giving drinks to their friends. And I don't want to deal with it anyway, or not showing up. Yeah, I think as someone is, look, you got a couple $100,000. You need to start with the end in mind. Start to build that thesis. When you have that thesis of like, this is the type of business I want and why, because it's going to allow me to coach my kids' soccer teams or allow the flexibility, or I'm okay to move anywhere in the nation, but I want to be in this industry. You start to nail it down very quickly, and then you can do a targeted search and say, okay, let's go in all after it.
I freaking love it. Guys listening, have you guys heard this before? Have you heard about this clarity thing before from a guy that talks into a podcast microphone? No, dude, it's exactly what you're saying. You begin with the freaking end of mind, and people, they nod and they smile when I tell them that. And then they're just like, okay, I'm not going to do that, but this is cute. Because they're like, dude, give me the tactics. What are we talking about here? I'm like, no, that's a huge thing for you to know is I don't want to run this business. There was a long period of time where I was like really close to buying laundromats until I just was like, yeah, I was doing due diligence. I was under contract on a couple of them at the same time. And I was just like, I don't want to be dealing with this. This doesn't sound fun to me whatsoever. And I understand it doesn't need to be fun, passive income to passionate income and all stuff. But still, and then on the flip side, it's like my buddy AJ, like he listened to the podcast and he ended up buying some franchise locations, some units of a painting business. And that got him out of his job in Atlanta, Georgia. So yeah, he bought a couple of those. That was really sick because he was clear from listening to the podcast. He's like, this is what I want. This is the cash flow I need. I am fine with it being local, but I'm going to have a manager run it. But he's actually enjoying it and he's crushing it. But it's just like knowing what you want and what you're getting out of the business is so huge, and especially if you're going to be the operator of it.
Oh yeah, totally. You're changing your day-to-day and your life entirely. Your buddy AJ, one of his clear goals was probably to get out of his day-to-day job. great. Okay, let's do that. And that painting business was his ticket to do that.
Exactly.
You and I can look at businesses and you'd be like, dude, that's the best business on earth. I got to buy this thing. And I'm going to look at it and say, hey, this thing sucks. This is the worst business on earth. And it's because you and I have different goals. We have different skill sets. We have different risk tolerances and different Rolodexes. And so it's not that every business out there is going to be a perfect fit for everybody, but there's probably a few businesses out there that's going to be a fit for you as a listener.
Yeah. So let's close this out with another one that's really important. And that is, as a broker, Ryan, there are people that email you and introduce themselves to you. And you go, huh, this is a person worth my time. And there's also another person that emails you where you're like, this person's kicking tires and I'm going to put them to the bottom of my list. I'm not sending them jack. So there's a huge difference, especially this happens in commercial real estate. This happens in businesses. How can somebody approach you? What comes first, the chicken or the egg? What comes first, the experience or the deal? How can somebody approach you buying their first business to where you're like, God, this is such a good outreach. Even if they're on their first deal, I could tell they're serious about what they're doing and I'm really going to help them and prioritize them to make sure that this deal gets done.
Wonderful question. People don't ask this. I don't know why. People don't ask this. And it's going to be very similar from the broker in real estate. And let me take it from what is the broker job to begin with, right? The broker job is to save the owner a ton of time from the tire kickers, right? That's the whole point. So I'll give you some things to not do, right? And this is extremely common. I'll have a listing and it goes live and I'll get emails and it says, hey, will the seller accept seller financing? Seller financing is a delayed payment. So say, for example, I put 80% down on the business and then 20% is paid out over a year or two, right?
Correct.
There's a million different ways to structure seller notes. There's 100% seller note, which is means you're not putting any money down. Or there's even 5% seller note, which is you're putting 95% down and then 5% is paid out over time. It's such a weird question because are you talking about 100% seller note or are you talking about a 5% seller note? Obviously, a seller who's got a good business isn't going to want to just be like, hey, I'll take all the risk. You take my business and I hope you pay me down the road. There has to be some give and take in there. So the number one thing is, if you're asking about seller notes, it's all built on trust. It's trust with the seller, right? It's the seller has to trust you that you're going to do well with the business and pay them back. And that's when interesting things can happen. So the first thing is they'll do some lowball offer, right? If a business has been on the market for 12 months, maybe start throwing out the lowball offers, but that's not going to drive someone to the top of any seller's list, right? So the broker is literally trying to save time. So what you need to do is differentiate yourself from everybody else. All right, let's jump in. How do you do that? One is, if you're asking questions that are very vague or questions that can be found in the business package, that's turn off. You don't read the business package. And some of our business packages are 30 pages, right? There's a lot of information in there. 95% of the questions that you could ask are probably in there. So what does that mean? You start asking questions that are like, oh, very simple. And it could have been found on page two. That's the quickest way to get a turnoff from a seller because they're like, hey, I just put 20 hours in to building this package with the broker. I don't want anything to do with you. That's the biggest turnoff because they know you haven't read the package and you're not serious about buying the business. And if you do go down this path and you start finding a business that you like, don't be asking silly questions that you should have learned and already known, right? And so how you can stand out is ask thoughtful questions. Stand out by saying, hey, this is a little bit about me. This is why I like this business. And this is my financing. I'm bringing all cash. I have backers. I have a family office, whatever. Because that's the other piece is everybody wants to buy a business, but that doesn't mean they have the funds to do it. So give them a clear option to say yes. And you might say, I don't want to tell the broker too much, right? Well, at the end of the day, if I have 200 people sending me inquiries, who do you think is going to go to the top? The ones who can actually get the deal done, who are committed to the deal. They've got the funds lined up. Those are the people that are going to drive to the top. And then of course, say you start getting on calls with a seller, you want to differentiate yourself by asking amazing questions, knowing that you have looked inside the business inside and out. You're asking questions that he hasn't answered or she hasn't answered yet. Those are the pieces that are going to allow you to stick out. And does it take time? Yeah, absolutely. This isn't, let me scroll through Biz Buy Sell. Let me scroll through Instagram and find a business for sale. It's hard, right? It's not easy, which is why buying a great business takes a lot of time and it can take people a few months to even a few years to find the right business.
Yeah. The kicker is at the end of the day, you maybe even just need one a year. Like you bought eight over 10 years and that was enough.
I don't know if I recommend that. Don't do that.
Yeah. Another thing that's really interesting that I want your take, and by the way, thank you for that because, and maybe I need to have you come speak to our community too, because there's a lot of them where to their credit, like they're like, hey, I'm new to this and I want to approach this the correct way. I do want to buy a business. I will take a business down, but I just don't know what I don't know yet. And so normally our advice is, hey, if I'm buying a business, I'm probably not buying it by myself. What I'm going to do is I'm going to find another partner that I'm going to split equity with, and I'm going to leverage their balance sheet and their experience when I'm emailing a broker. And I'm going to say, hey, we have been in this space for this long. We do this. So right. It's just, and that's the cheat code that I use to get over the experience hump. Another question that I have, and then we'll close out, is the size of the deal. The size of the deal. And this has been such an interesting point that has been made to me from a couple of previous interviews that I've done, where it's in real estate, people are like, I'll do a crappy $200,000 house or $300,000 house, fix it up, refinance it for $500,000. So therefore, that same logic applies to a business. I'm going to start with a $300,000 business and I'm going to buy it for $300,000. And then, yeah, maybe I'm not making so much, but I just want to get my feet wet before I move into the $3 million business. But I got advice from one guy where I actually wholeheartedly agree with him, where he goes, it is better to buy the $3 million business because that's an actual business. The $300,000 one is going to be a dumpster fire and you're going to want to freaking jump off of a cliff. So I'm curious about your opinion on that.
Well, you nailed it. And let me give some examples, and then I'll actually give some counter arguments too that I think should be applicable to many too. So generally, the bigger the business, the better the business. Why does Google trade for 20x revenue? They're Google. They're not going to go to zero, right? They do $100 billion in revenue every quarter, $400 billion a year, right? So obviously, the bigger the business, the better it is, right? When you have a business that's a few hundred grand, it's still going to all revolve around the owner. There's not enough profit in there to actually bring in a manager. You get to a $3 million business and they're pulling in 20% margins, you can hire a manager for 150K plus profit sharing, and you can do all the things that you couldn't do before. So absolutely, the bigger the business, the better typically it's going to be. Now, the reverse of that is, if I don't have any experience in something and I'm just going to go sign a personal guarantee on $3 million and I have no clue what I'm doing, that's probably not the best business for me, right? I need to go find a partner. I need to go find some experience. And that's where buying smaller can actually get your feet wet. You learn a bunch of you learn a bunch of things, you make a bunch of mistakes that aren't going to bankrupt you. And That's where starting small can actually be very helpful. And it's funny, like the example you just gave, I have a friend of mine who did that 15 years ago, bought a tiny business, worked weekends and everything. And about 2 years in, got put in Costco. They're doing $100 million a year now, right? So there isn't a right size fits all. But you also have to overlay the size with what you're trying to accomplish, or in addition, your risk tolerance. Okay. So your risk tolerance is very different. If you sign a personal guarantee on a few hundred thousand dollars, you're going to lose sleep. But if you sign it on $3 million, you're going to lose sleep too. So yes, generally saying the bigger the businesses are better. At the same time, some people might say, I just want to make an extra 10 grand a month. Great. Go buy that $300,000 business, run it on the side, and you can do that. And you don't have to quit your day job. And then I've seen people build insane wealth by buying $100,000 to $300,000 businesses, running them for a few years, and then selling them after they've grown them 20, 30% year over year, and they double them 3 years later, and then they sell them. It really depends on your risk tolerance, what your goals are, but I would wholeheartedly agree, generally speaking, the bigger the business, the better it is, which is why you look on publicly on the stock market, those businesses, they just have a lot of things that small businesses don't have. In the end, a small business is a small business for a reason. It quite has turned the corner yet.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes, I forget who said it, but it's the biggest mistake of a small business owner is thinking like a small business.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really like that one.
You referenced Naval earlier. And like a perfect example of Naval always talks about is Naval Ravikant. When he talks about the store owner, the Chinese store owner on the corner is working 80-hour weeks, but so is the guy who's trying to send rockets to space. Like they're actually working the same amount on the same, but it's a 10 times opportunity. Or a 10 out of 10 opportunity with this big business or thinking big versus like your opportunity for the local Chinese restaurant on the corner is negative one out of 10.
That's why I tell people, I'm like, hey, let's not focus on single family real estate right now when you could spend that year learning about business acquisition, or you could spend that year learning about commercial real estate, which both of those avenues are where you're going to get to eventually. Like, that's where all roads lead to. Like, you're going to buy your single family houses and it's going to be fun. Maybe you have a couple short term rentals and then you're going to get sick of them. You're going to roll them up into commercial. And then eventually you're going to come to the very end of the game where you're like, wait a second, this whole business thing is even more fun. You're going to go back. Because how all the billionaires and all the 100 millionaires and everyone, they're all there from mergers and acquisition. Like, it's all private equity. That's where that comes from. And then they roll their profits into real estate, or they have real estate related businesses for bonus points on the board game, to where they don't pay taxes ever.
Yeah, they make their money in business and then put it all in real estate because their next generation can't screw up real estate as easily as screwing up their business, in my opinion.
Bingo. So, man, where can people find you, hear you more, talk about businesses, all this different stuff?
Yeah, I'm always happy to be sounding board, happy to chat with anybody. You can find me at letsbuybusiness.com, Let's Buy a Business, the podcast. You can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter, any of those, and I'm sure there'll be links in the bio.
Awesome. Awesome. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on, brother.
Thanks, Brian.
It's been Brian and Ryan with the Action Academy Podcast, signing off.
Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it. So I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want. And I can only do that with your help. There are 2 main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 or 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.